We're approaching the holidays, of course. This week is Thanksgiving week. And the holidays bring out and put on display the dynamics of our families, don't they? What's true all year round, very often we might not attend to, but when the holiday season comes around, we see our families and give attention to them and are aware of the dynamics of our families. That's often a beautiful thing, where we'll maybe be reminded of a niece or nephew we don't always see and realize how they've grown and new things that have happened. We appreciate one another. We find occasion to be grateful for what God's doing and the dynamic of our family. But sometimes it's hard. The holiday season brings up tension that exists in families. A particular kind of tension is going to be displayed or made known to us in the text we have before us, chapter 3, beginning chapter 3 of 1 Peter today. And it's the tension between husband and wife, where one is a believer in Jesus Christ and the other is not. And again, that kind of a marriage may have, you know, an accommodation made where it's not so much an issue all the time, but in something like a Thanksgiving dinner, for instance, it's likely to come up, isn't it? Where the believing spouse will want to actually offer thanks to someone. Where there's gratitude being offered to a living God who is better to us than we can even acknowledge. And so we should pray words of thanks. And we should find ourselves in God's presence on an occasion like this. And the unbelieving spouse wants the event to be about dinner and food and a couple of days off work. And so there's some difficulty. And the fact that one is a believer and one is not might well come up on an occasion like that. Well, as I said, the text we're going to consider this morning has that issue central to it. And I want to read and we'll begin our discussion, our consideration of this text. Verse 1 of 1 Peter 3. Wives, in the same way, be submissive to your husbands, so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over without words by the behavior of their wives, when they see the purity and reverence of your lives. Your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as braided hair and the wearing of gold jewelry and fine clothes. Instead, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. For in this way, the holy women of the past who put their hope in God used to make themselves beautiful. They were submissive to their own husbands, like Sarah, who obeyed Abraham and called him her master. You are her daughters if you do what is right and do not give way to fear. Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives and treat them with respect as the weaker partner and as heirs with you of the grace of the gift, the gracious gift of life, so that nothing will hinder your prayers. I want to make sure that we note the context of these verses, because I think it's very easy to misunderstand or not gain all that we could from them if we don't take note of the context. The very first phrase of verse 1 is in the same way, wives in the same way. And that phrase is hearkening back to all that's we've seen toward the middle and end of chapter 2. Context is very important when we try and understand what the Bible's teaching us. There's an old joke about a man who was kind of in desperate straits once, and he had a Bible and he wanted, you know, a word from God, and so he flipped open his Bible and pointed to a page and looked down, expecting to hear something from God. Of course, no context involved, just the pointing of a finger. And it rested on the phrase, Judas went out and hanged himself. So he thought, oh, that's a little scary. So he shut the Bible, opened it again, put his finger and says, go and do likewise. It's getting worse. And he opened it a third time and pointed his finger, what you do, do quickly. And hopefully he didn't respond to what he was discovering. But the reason that doesn't work is we have to read those verses in their context. And here, Peter is speaking about a marriage in which there is a believer and an unbeliever. But he hearkens back to the call that sojourners, those of us who follow Christ in a world that is unwelcome to the gospel message, who who live among those who aren't believers, who find ourselves in the lower place, we should submit, Peter says, to government. We should submit to an autocratic government, even, to despotic economic masters, even. And now in this text, we find a patriarchal marriage, a strongly unchallenged patriarchal marriage, and the call to submit is before us. The language of submission is found in other texts about marriage in the New Testament that are different than this one. And I would want to make the point because I think they're often thought to be the same. In Ephesians, we read the context, a context of mutual submission in which the husband is head of the wife, leading the pair in a beautiful dance. And embrace a beautiful dance to the music of heaven. It is a bond that mirrors the relationship between Christ and the church. So there is somewhat similar language used in Ephesians with a different context and a different instruction. Here, the submission is spoken of to, in verse 7, the woman being a weaker partner or weaker vessel. Not someone who is the equal of her husband with a different responsibility. This is a patriarchal environment. And it is, again, if we harken back to the context, the context is one of slaves needing to be submissive to their husbands. And most of all, Jesus being required to submit to the unjust ruling of both Jews and Romans who finally executed him. We read of the requirement of Jesus, when he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to the one who judges justly. So in this case, we find women who have come to Christ. This is a young church, most of them already married, heard the gospel message, have come to Christ, now are living in marriages where their husbands don't believe and where their husbands have a great deal of authority over them. Authority granted not from creation or not from redemption, but authority granted because of a patriarchal structure in which they find themselves. And what is the responsibility of the wife in that case? How will she trust God? It's in the same way that Jesus trusted one who would take care of him when he faced the cross. So that's the context we're in. I think we have a lot we can learn, as we did in chapter 2, from this time and place and this instruction, even though it's unfamiliar to us mostly. In the same way that we don't live in a world with either kings or slaves, we don't live in a world of marriages that are unchallenged patriarchies. But I think we'll find enormous wisdom in this text about how we can trust God in circumstances that are difficult, that are tense, even in marriages where one is a believer and one is not, and how would God use us there. So let's return down to verse 1. It says, "Wives, in the same way, be submissive to your husbands, so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over without words by the behavior of their wives when they see the purity and reverence of your lives." So the big argument here is one that we've seen over and over again in this book, and that is behavior, how you live, who you are, is a great deal more important than the things you merely say. That language by itself, uttering pronouncements, making arguments, speaking up here and there and everywhere, is less influential, if that's all there is, merely speech, than the behavior, the life, the actions you take, the kind of person you are. So Peter is saying it's your behavior, not words. He will be won without a word by your behavior, is the big idea. Now let me make a couple of observations about how we should probably picture the scene into which Peter's writing. First of all, there is an unbelieving husband and a believing wife. The unbelieving husband knows the gospel. It says that he's not persuaded by it, that he's refused to believe it, but he's at least heard it. And I think it would be wrong for a wife who is a new Christian who has a husband that's never heard the gospel to not speak up. Certainly, that the idea is, if I care about my husband and my family, I ought to tell the good news that has been persuasive to me. And there are some people that are afraid to ever speak up, and that's not the point here. We need to care enough about everybody to say what's true, to offer the arguments, to marshal the evidence, to winsomely say the great message of the gospel. That's critical. But this guy, having heard it, doesn't want to hear it anymore. I'm not persuaded by this message. And so then, what is the responsibility of the wife? A second thing we can observe in this is that she longs for her husband to know the Lord. She wants him to be won to Christ, that is, to be persuaded. That her Christianity is no reason for her to walk away from her marriage or be done with her husband or the unbelieving lout. What good is he anyway? And there's no indication that faith gives this wife permission to be less committed to her marriage or less attentive or less concerned. She is hoping for her husband to turn around. And that's Peter's giving her help with that responsibility, that longing. She probably, in many cases, loves her husband. And certainly she wants her home to be a place where the Lord is honored and where together people who can grow up and grow strong in their faith. She wants that sort of home. And again, I think it may very well be that she loves the man in many of these cases. But he doesn't want to hear anything about her faith. So Peter says, without words, be a woman who is changed by your allegiance to Christ. Let him see what it is to have one in his home, in his life, next to him in his endeavors, who has the presence of the Holy Spirit changing her, making her new. Chaste and respectful behavior, he says. Not respectful of him in this case. It's not like she is more subservient to her husband because she's a Christian. Her respect is for Christ. Her respect is for her master, her Lord. And her behavior now is evidencing change because she wants to please him. Honoring her husband, respecting her husband, but pleasing the Lord. And what changes might happen in a setting like that? And you can see this husband looking on his wife and say, you know, she used to be grumpy all the time. Nothing was, you know, this is, I mean, good woman, I think the world of her, but boy, she was a grumpy person, but not so much anymore. Or she was bored all the time. Or she was always worried about money. Or she couldn't get enough of those soap operas and sort of celebrity, salacious adultery stories. She doesn't seem so interested in those things anymore. She's humming tunes. She never used to hum. What is she doing? Humming tunes all the time and reading books that she didn't used to be interested in. And who is this person? She's not requiring anything of me, but she's becoming a different person. She isn't so jealous of her sister anymore, frightened by every little thing. And what happened? And so Peter's writing and saying, as he sees a person, and clearly this is not, I mean, we can make absolute application to both genders here, can't we? Especially in a world in which the difference between husbands and wives and their freedom and their opportunities and so on are so much closer aligned in our culture than in the first century. But if we say it's not enough for us to just speak, we need to be who we're called to be, and that is the great persuader. I think we're understanding what Peter's arguing here. What would be the alternative to that, where you just talk, but you don't change? There's no particular evidence of Christ in your life, but you have a lot to say about him. I think the word nagging comes to mind, doesn't it? And pressure, and argumentation, and fault finding. Well, if you knew Jesus, you'd be different, and you know, on it, just a sort of repetitive discussion of the husband's inadequacies and failures and shortcomings and expectations spoken over and over again, repetitively, and so on. Peter's saying, effectively, that does no good. And in fact, you know, the worst possible outcome may come from that. And that is, if you nag long enough, you might get him to sort of agree on the outside without ever being changed on the inside. Just to bring peace to the environment. Okay, I'll go to your darn church. All right, you know, we'll have, you know, I'll give money to whatever organization. I'll do something. I will, on the outside, appear to be in agreement with you, but I am farther than ever from believing anything of the things you believe. That man who has been nagged into some sort of external, or woman, frankly, some sort of external behavior is further from faith than the person who says, I want nothing to do with it, probably, because he, and I think that that danger may be highlighted here, may be in view here. Moving from just the couple that is Peter's writing to, this wife and this husband, again, it seems to me that a major thrust of instruction in this book, in the book of 1 Peter, is that who we are speaks louder, more powerfully than anything else, you know, kind of any use of language that doesn't isn't connected to life. It is especially true when we are in positions of weakness, when we are slaves, when we are facing harsh governments, when we are in positions where we have less money and less voice and less to offer and can't be heard, and we live out the incarnation of Christ so that there is a fragrance about us, truth that can't be accounted for by just our humanity, where God must be given credit for what people see. When that is true, it changes everything. Changes everything. And that idea is being applied in this setting by the Apostle Peter. So, he's saying words alone are not a persuader, are not, in fact, they'll have the opposite effect if we're not careful, just a kind of nagging language. Another option that a wife in this setting can resort to, another kind of persuader, is physical beauty. And that is taken up in verse 3. Again, speaking to the same wife who's married to a husband who refuses to believe. Your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as braided hair and the wearing of gold jewelry and fine clothes. Instead, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. For this is the way in which this is the way the holy women of the past who put their hope in God used to make themselves beautiful. They were submissive to their own husbands, like Sarah, who obeyed Abraham and called him her master. You are her daughters if you do what is right and do not give way to fear. Beauty should be from the inside breaking out into view, not imposed externally. Men tend to be visual creatures. Most men, like it or not, are often sort of attracted by what they see. And a woman's beauty is a source of power for her. A wife who is effective at being suggestive and alluring and beguiling can, by that means, get her husband's attention, can change his behavior by being desirable in a particular way that is being kind of used by her to bring about her ends. That is an option. But Peter's saying it's not one that you should resort to. Again, it's going to have the same problem of you can perhaps change your husband's behavior with some sort of resort to an alluring appearance. But you're not going to change his heart in the final analysis. And you won't get what you really hope for. There's another way in which physical beauty, I think, can become a power to influence somebody, a power wives have to influence someone, and that is by making yourself attractive to some other man, perhaps, so that your husband is worried about losing you, and then the issues of jealousy are raised, and the concept of a trophy wife who has this sort of, looks so good that her husband is gained some kind of standing with other men and other people looking on and that sort of thing. Physical beauty has a power to it. And it's a power that someone can resort to using, but not in the kind of persuasion that's being hoped for here. There was a survey published earlier this year, in either August or September, the General Social Survey, which has been done over and over again throughout, I don't know how long they've been doing it, but it's some government organization that asks a bunch of questions and publishes their findings. And one of the things they said that sort of made it into the news is they were comparing the level of happiness of women in 2009 with that of the general level of happiness of women in 1972. So after almost 40 years, during which arguments for women's independence and identity and strength and value as individuals and have all been made strongly throughout this period of time, women are more unhappy in 2009 than they were in 1972. And one of the discussions that was made by one observer of this survey was the sort of desperate pressure to look good that women in today's society are under, even more than they were almost 40 years ago. It's sort of counterintuitive on one level. Well, if I'm valued as a person and I'm no longer just subject to men and sort of their view of me, it ought to be the case, if these things are true, that I am not so burdened by how I look and judged by my appearance, but in fact it's worse now than it ever was. Kids are made to dress and look like many adults at a much earlier age. They're sexualized much earlier and called on to appear a certain way in order to be valued at an earlier age, at a continuing age, continuing throughout their lives. The trap of you are what you appear to be is worse than it ever was. And as women become older, to go on, older in life and have the appearance of someone who's lived for 40 or 50 or 60 or 70 years, there's new tools to fight against that, against what age does. Botox and breast sculpture and whatever else is available now and that didn't used to be. So the tools are there to still worship my appearance, and so the pressure is there to engage in being judged by how you look, and it's worse now than it ever was. It's foolishness, Peter's saying, to rest on one's appearance as an argument for influencing someone to do what has eternal value. That's the wrong way to think, even though it's available perhaps, and maybe you can get your husband to act in a certain way that you want him to act. If you resort to that, don't do it, is what he's saying. He brings up Sarah in this context, and I think it's interesting to remember the story of Sarah and Abraham. There is no place in Genesis, in the account of Sarah and Abraham's life together, where she calls him Lord or Master. There's no phrasing. We don't have that phrase there. And I think what Peter means is this, that the marriage of Sarah and Abraham is one of the best drawn, the most fully drawn in all of the Bible. We sort of meet them early on. We know what their struggles are. We see them struggle over decades, and they wrestle with ideas, and they are good to each other at times and bad to each other at times. And Sarah is sometimes a fairly negative influence in Abraham's life. She has bad ideas that he ends up adopting at times, and he threatens her by his behavior, and she laughs at the wrong time, and this is a very fully drawn, nuanced marriage that's presented to us. But I think the point Peter's making when it says that Sarah called him master is that she threw in her lot with him at the beginning of their life together when they left Ur of the Chaldees. And she knew that Abraham had been made promises, and Abraham had a journey to take, and Abraham had a destiny to live out. And she said, your journey will be my journey. The promises made by God that you will have a son, he will be my son. My life will never step away from you. I am committed in this relationship to share your journey as God has given it to you. And that commitment is the choice Sarah made that's indicated here. But the reason I think her name is in this place, in this argument, is that she was a stunning beauty. She was evidently a dramatically beautiful woman. And we know that because twice, and even at very great age for her, Abraham knew that when he went to a new place, she would be desired by the powerful men of that region. She would stand out. She would attract the interest of the Pharaoh first and of Abimelech later in their journeys. So Sarah was a woman of apparently very stunning beauty, who in the long run did not choose to treat her husband as someone who could be manipulated by it. In her relationship with Abraham, that never is an issue. That is never something that seems to be part of the way they lived out their life together. And he is saying of Sarah that her fearlessness in all the difficult circumstances, her willingness to cast her lot in with her husband, to make the journey that he would make, is evidence that she knew God was faithful. And that he had promised them an outcome, and she would trust him, in spite of everything, for that outcome. Fearlessness is kind of the last of the observation Peter makes about wives who want to influence their husbands who don't yet believe. Living holy lives, living beautiful lives, a gentle and quiet spirit. I think in this context, that phrase doesn't refer to a personality type, a kind of soft-spoken, demure woman. He's saying it's a woman who's not anxious, who's not afraid. The gentle and quiet spirit is the opposite of a fearful spirit, an anxious, dithering, overwhelmed, non-gentle person because of fear. Rather, Sarah lived a life that was unafraid. He is commending to the wives who receive this letter that they should trust God in the face of whatever choices their husbands are making. And as these men see your willingness to stand alongside them no matter what, the changes God is making in your life to produce beauty and joy and peace, as they see that you are not afraid of the future because you know who holds the future, as they see these things, and it has been true in every generation from 4,000 years ago, in our case, Abraham's time till now, they will find that they can't resist in the final analysis, or in most cases cannot resist the implications of what it means to have a Christian wife, God present in her, in our marriage. The word to husbands is much shorter in verse 7. And it's much shorter probably because it was less commonly a problem that a believing husband would have an unbelieving wife in these churches. That if the husband came to Christ, most often because of the power imbalance, the wife would find herself persuaded of his faith. So it's less frequently the case that the division between husband and wife will be one where the husband believes and the wife does not. Now that's more common in our age, of course, where equality between husbands and wives and independence of thought and so on is more familiar to us. And I think it's worth considering what Peter has to say about husbands here. Verse 7. Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives, and treat them with respect as the weaker partner and as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life, so that nothing will hinder your prayers. think what he's saying is this. You can make your wife do what you tell her. I mean, that's implied. That you are the master of your home. The world of these people was very patriarchal. And if you tell her to do whatever she ought to do, or go wherever she ought to go, or wear clothing that looks Christian, or buy a new Bible and carry it around with her, or whatever she ought to do, if you can tell her what to do, and she will probably, you can make her do what you want her to do. But again, if you want her heart to be changed, if you long for someone, for her to know the Lord as you know the Lord, then recognize that in this culture, she has less independence. She has less personal authority. She has less ability to stand up for herself. Understand her role and be considerate of it. Walk in her shoes, if you will. Imagine what it would be like to be in her circumstances. Grant her respect as a fellow heir of the grace of life. Treat her as someone who is to be elevated and to be honored and to be believed and to be listened to. Understand her situation. Treat her with respect. And the concern Peter has for husbands is that if you don't do that, your prayers will be hindered. If you don't treat her the way God sees her, the way God treats you, you'll find it very difficult to have freedom in your prayers. You're stiff-arming God in the treatment of your wife and expecting Him to hear your prayers. And the argument is, if you believe and she doesn't yet know what you know, elevate her so she can know it. Care for her. Understand her. Walk in her shoes. Know what it's like. We're coming up on Thanksgiving this week, as I mentioned earlier. And at the Thanksgiving table, our families will be on some display, at least to those of us who are there. We'll see things as they are. And some will be great. In some cases, there will be tensions. Sometimes, occasionally, the tension is between one spouse who believes and the other who doesn't. And Peter wants this husband to live in such a way that his wife will come to know the Lord that he knows. He longs for the wife to have her changes in discipleship to Christ be clear enough so that her husband can be compelled by it, can be persuaded by it. No longer afraid. Willing and respectful, willing to be respectful to him, but to serve someone greater than him. A woman of greater substance than he's ever known. These things are there as they're sitting around the table together. These are the powerful, life-changing influences. How do we help someone know what we have been privileged to know? And again, Peter's argument, I think, is consistent all the way through. Who we are speaks louder by far than any argument we make, any fulmination we declare, any demand that we insist upon. Let's pray that God will make us the kind of people that have influence as He's displayed it to us here. Lord, help us, especially in our families. We want so much, Lord, for our families to have You at the center. And sometimes our longing for that trips us up. But whether it's in our families or whether it's in any other place, use our lives. Speak through our actions and behaviors and character. Words of kindness, deeds of mercy, courage that didn't used to be there. Make us the kind of people, Lord, whose lives display Christ so that our Lord Jesus will receive the glory. In His name we pray. Amen.